The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to be here. Sandra Cisneros explores themes of place, identity, and the lives of the working class in her novels, poems, and short stories, including Woman Hollering Creek and other stories, Loose Woman, and of course, her classic coming-of-age novel, The House on Mango Street, which is required reading in schools around the world. Her many honors include National Endowment for the Arts fellowships in both poetry and fiction, a MacArthur Fellowship, and the National Medal of the Arts Award presented to her by President Obama in 2016. The New York Times Book Review calls her not only a gifted writer, but an absolutely essential one. This evening, she will be joined in conversation with poet, novelist, critic, and journalist, Luis J. Rodriguez. Thank you so much for being here. The screen is all yours.
Thank you. What a blessing, Sandra, to be able to share this. I said it earlier, but I mean it. You're one of my favorite people. We've known each other. I don't even know if it's three decades. I don't know. But a long time, and our friendship has stayed very rich, and I appreciate it. We don't see each other that often, as you know, but when we do, we always have this kind of connection, and I really appreciate it. Trini, my wife, says hello. Everybody here at the Achuchas, they know that I'm talking with you. They all love you, as you know. Everybody here loves you. So I think this is a great opportunity. And again, we are promoting this very beautiful, wonderful book, Martita, Remember You, which I think will be the main thing we're going to talk about, but I know we're going to share other things. Mm-hmm. The one thing I just want to start maybe, because I think the book is important, to make sure we don't lose sight of that. I read the book. I found it to be extremely, and I know that the word sensuous gets used a lot and everything, but I think what's really powerful was the presence of the women, the presence of of you as an author. And when people say, well, there's three women in Paris, that could go all kinds of ways. What I loved about this was the descriptive images, the power of being able to get a soul sense of these relationships and how important relationships are. I mean, it isn't, there's a lot of things that happens with these women, you know, but not a lot of big dramatic things. The one thing I liked is Corina says, the protagonist, she says, I'm waiting for something big to happen. But I think what's beautiful is that it doesn't require a big, big thing for people to live. You know what I'm saying? To find life in its depth. I think that's where other things happen. Relationships, misrelationships, you know, all kinds of things happens. But I think what's beautiful is just being present with the medicine of your friends was very powerful. Maybe you can speak on that.
Yeah, well, another city that's mentioned in the book besides Paris is Chicago, a town we both know very well, Luis. So that's why it's very special that you're here tonight, gifting us all, but especially me, the gift of your time. And, you know, the older we get, the more I appreciate the most expensive thing we can give one another is time. So thank you for taking the time to be here with me to celebrate Martita, to read it and share it with the viewers today. I always enjoy talking to you because you're one of the people of my generation that I respect. You know, we've come a long way. We've grown up together. Now we're the elders together as we lose some of our elders, like Rudy Anaya's gone. And, you know, we're coming up to our own time when we'll be on the front lines. But this story for me, you know, started a long time ago when I was probably 35, I wrote it. And put it away and took it out of storage because I couldn't finish it. It was supposed to be part of Woman Hollering Creek. And I couldn't get to an end that was satisfactory for anybody, including me. So I put it aside, came back to it, and it was inspired by real people, real women, real friendships, and people I met when I was traveling. When I was 28, I got an NEA grant that allowed me to finish House on Mongoose Street. And I bought a one-way ticket from Chicago first to Boston, and I went to Provincetown to try to finish the book. And then another ticket from New York City to Athens to, I didn't finish the book in Provincetown. I had to finish it in Athens, in Idra, on an island in the Aegean. And after I did my homework and mailed the manuscript from Syntagma Square in Athens, then I was free to travel. And I wanted to travel because, you know, for those of us who come from working class homes, our family doesn't encourage us to travel. They want us to stay close. Why you want to go there? You know, something could happen to you. Or if you do go somewhere, it's like, take your brother. You know, in my family, it was always take your brother, one of your brothers, because I have six. And, you know, I really wanted to learn how to voyage on my own without being afraid. Growing up in Humble Park, and you know Humble Park, my father would always send one of my six brothers to pick me up or to wait at the bus stop or to take me somewhere, because it was the kind of neighborhood you couldn't go to the bus stop alone without male or female, without encountering trouble. So, you know, I had this terrifying dream of traveling and not being able to communicate, of getting lost, of something terrible, unmentionable happening to me. And I wanted to get over that fear. So that's all the backstory. But then everywhere I went, I met incredible women in different countries. They were friends to me, sometimes for a day or a weekend or a couple of months. Some I still stay in touch with, some I lost. And writing this story was a means for me to gather all of the Marquitas in my life that I met during that trip and subsequent trips, and to write about them and gain clarity of what those people that sometimes come into our lives so briefly when we're in need, when we depend on the kindness of strangers, you know, what do they mean to us? So maybe this story looks like three people, but in my mind, it's more than three.
Well, yes. And I found it to be really a book of gratitude.
Yes.
That's right. And you know, there's a lot of gratitude to know these women, to have lived with them, to have shared things, part of the book. And in the end, there's a lot of gratitude for having known those relationships. And I think that's important because people can't, or maybe they can't imagine that books could be about that. But this book is definitely, you gotta slow down, take your time, and really see the world, and then really be grateful that you could do that. Maybe you can speak a little bit about that, because I found that to be very powerful.
Well, you know, I think the whole pandemic has been an awakening spiritually for me to have gratitude, as you say, for every moment, for the lives we're living, and for those of us who have family members, as you do, who are ill or have been ill, or friends who have crossed over. It really makes us genuinely aware of how much we depend on one another for our well-being. And that's a powerful spiritual belief, that in order for me to be safe, I have to take care of you. That is key to many ancient religions, and it's certainly true with this pandemic waking us up to that reality, that we have to take care of each other and the planet and the animals and the environment if it's going to take care of us. That's a true indigenous belief, Keno.
It is, absolutely. And you know, again, the book really resonates with me on that, because as the pandemic seemed to be going down, I know it goes up and down, I made a lot of calls to a lot of friends. I realized that I was so busy that I was forgetting those relationships, and I just called people and I just checked in with them, and it turned out to be sometimes I would talk to them for quite a long time. We hadn't talked in a long time, And so I think that is what's really powerful, what you just said.
You need to check in with you. You're reminding me because I never want to bother you, but I need to check in with you because the dialogue supports one another, guides us. Yeah. And I need support hearing from you. Just hearing that, that's going to make me get on the phone. Yeah.
We need to. And I'm not much of a talker that way. That's kind of weird, but I need to be because how else do we connect nowadays? One thing I do want to say about Chicago, and I think that's one thing that ties us. And I love the idea that was brought up, that the working class. And Chicago is a thoroughly working class city. It's one of the, I love Chicago. It's my second home. My daughter ended up in the same high school that you were at, Josephinum. She ended up there. And we lived in Humboldt Park as well. And so what I loved about those neighborhoods and the people and how gracious they could be, it's hard life. Chicago is no joke. It's a hard life. But I've always loved about the openness that people had. And their first move is to be kind. It may be the second move by mean I'm going to get you, but the first move is to be kind, which is quite extraordinary. You know, I've been to New York City, for example. I love New York City. I've been going there for 40 years. I got friends. I got a granddaughter in Brooklyn, you know, so. But I think the first move in New York City is to be mean. And then they get kind. You know what I'm saying? You start getting characters for people in different cities. And I mean, right away, New York City, they'll tell you what you think. Get out of the way. But then if you sit down and talk with them, they're actually good people. In Chicago, the first move is a kind move, you know, to be really nice. And then, of course, if you give them a dirty look, you're done. But and I love that about that we have those connections. And I think it's the working class, the old steel mills, the stockyards that are all gone. But that still permeates the way people are. And I think that even shows in your books, because I think your books carry, you're in the world, you're, I think, fortunate being a writer, we get to travel. And my wife tells me that traveling is one of the ways to get knowledge. Books is another way, but traveling is one of the good ways. I learned a lot traveling, but I never thought in my working class world that I would travel, as you say. We were stuck to our body. We were stuck to this industry. We were stuck to where we were. And the fact that I could travel is a freeing thing, but I don't want to lose that groundedness. So I find that to be very important in your work. There's a lot of that working class, I don't know if it's aesthetic or whatever it is.
My father appears in this story, which I wrote before Caramelo, and his upholstery shop.
Yeah.
You know, which is something I know very intimately, and I had not written about it before until this story. Then later on, Caramelo came up with the upholstery again, but this was the first time that that working class shop appears in my work. And I forgot about that. You know, when I looked at the story and get, oh yeah, I wrote that so long ago. That was the first part of the story that I wrote decades ago. And then the middle and the last section I worked on more recently so that I could finish the story so it would have some closure. And I'm really happy with how it turned out. I'm happy to share it with a fellow Chicagoan who recognizes that West Hermosa Park neighborhood that I used to live in, west of Humboldt Park, as well as Humboldt Park.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, one of the things that my mom picked cotton in South Texas when she was 9 years old. So when I was 9 years old, she told me it was time for me to work. So there was an old rusty manual lawnmower. I got that lawnmower and I would drag it from neighbor to neighbor for 25 cents. I'd cut their lawns. And we're talking about people that didn't really have lawns. There were dirt yards with few little weeds there and there, but it didn't matter. I would cut their lawns at 25 cents. And she got me, I had that work ethic very young. You had to work to survive. And it was helpful in the sense of when you're a writer to have that self-discipline to get up in the morning. Because you know how people can say, well, I'm working for myself now and they don't got, you know, they're kicking back, they're drinking coffee all day long, you know, we're all drinking as some people do. But I think that working class ethic of get up, get the job done, and especially if you do it for yourself, it's better than when you do it for others who don't really care about you. You know what I'm saying? So I learned that from my mother. And one story connected to your dad is that she used to go around the neighborhood and pick up furniture to reupholster them on her own and then resell them or to the neighbors, which very cheaply.
Your mom did that?
My mom did that. She taught me, not my dad.
Are you talking about my mom? My mom did that too.
Yeah. That's really, that's how you have to do it. You go around the dumpster diving, pick up old stuff and remake them. And she taught me how to use a hammer.
My mom did that, but she didn't do it to sell it. She brought things home for us to use.
Yeah, my mom would do that too. The best stuff we kept. But then she would reposter them and sometimes she'd give them away. It really wasn't even about the money. And she eventually started making dolls. She found a doll's head in a dumpster and she put a beautiful dress around it. And then she started thinking about how can I buy these doll's heads? You know, those kind of doll's faces.
Yeah.
And then she found a way to do that where it was. And she started making all these dolls with different dresses.
But don't you think, Louise, that part of that isn't just surviving, but part of that is your spirit surviving?
Absolutely.
Because our spirit survives when we create, whether we're making a garden or a dress for a dumpster doll, or a chair you found in the alley. It's about keeping your spirit alive.
Yeah. And you know, for mothers and fathers, I guess, but for mothers in particular, my mother was so frustrated because she really couldn't be the artist that I'm sure she wanted to be. She couldn't do that. She had to take care of the kids. And my dad, well, I don't know if your dad was like this, was emotionally detached. You know what I'm saying? And so it made it harder because he wouldn't connect with the kids. He wouldn't connect with her. He had no intimacy. She stayed with him.
My father was emotionally available. My mother was the more detached one.
Okay,
I'm twitching around here. It's because sun is setting from my window.
Yeah.
So I'm twisting around so I don't get hit by the sunlight.
Okay.
But just so you know why I'm doing this little twist. So the sun.
That's okay. Then we get to see more of your little house there.
Oh, you can see that's beautiful. The entrance. And the thing in Mexico is when we do these Zooms, I have to sometimes get my assistant to stand outside, because even though you put a sign that says, favor de no tocar, no toque el timbre, vuelve en una hora, they still knock on the door. So I've done a lot of Zooms with Ernesto standing out in the street, not letting anyone knock on the door. And right now I have his daughter babysitting my dog so that they won't bark and upset.
Yes. Well, there you go.
During the plática. And then there's my my eternal Christmas tree.
Oh, that's
pre-pandemic. It's been up since then, because once the pandemic started, I was going to leave it up till the Fiesta de la Candelaria. But I thought, hey, once the pandemic started, I thought, we need that Christmas tree. So it's been up for...
Well, hopefully when everything's done, I might just come by and visit and knock on your door.
Siempre estás invitado. Tienes aquí tu casa. I don't say that to just anybody, but I say it to you.
Yeah, no. That'd be great. So anyway, I love this, that we're able to touch on family and working class spirit and the spirit of creativity, as you're saying, because even when work permeates, our gente, our family, try to be creative. They have to. Being creative keeps them human.
Especially when we're depressed, I found like when I've gotten into severe depressions, like clinical depressions, it's when I wasn't creating. And sometimes, like when we have those traumas, you know, like a death, a loss of a loved one, that we forget that if we made anything, a cake, a cupcake, a card, a song, a poem, a drawing, anything, make anything, a garden, that will save you for that day.
I have to say something that's kind of counter to what I said about my mom, but I still love my mom. She's gone now. She hated that I was going to be a writer.
What?
Yes. She thought it was a waste of time, una pérdida de tiempo. And she would, she burned all my writings. I had them in a grocery bag when I was a kid.
I read that. Wrote
she burned them. And she got rid of, I was painting. She got rid of all my murals, plywood murals. And, you know, I would get mad at her. But at the same time, now that I'm older and hopefully a little wiser, I totally get it. She grew up in a rough time in Mexico during the Mexican Revolution and the Cristero Rebellion. She grew up in a time where you had to work or die. She grew up in a time where you couldn't waste time. You know what I'm saying? And she...
Yeah, I do. Yeah.
And she was just trying to inculcate you know, something that she thought would be helpful. I think in the long run, before she died, we did reconcile. And she did tell me one thing that I always recognize. She says, "You're the only one of my brothers and sisters that did what I felt I needed to do." And she respected me for it. She may not have liked what I wanted to do, but she respected that I did it.
I had the opposite thing with my dad. Yeah. I had it with my dad, the same thing where, you know, he was like, didn't want me to become a writer. Mm-hmm. Just wanted me to get married and have children. And why did I choose to be poor? Because he knew I could get a job, a better paying job than the ones I was getting. And it was, but like you, at the end of my father's life, he understood, was proud of me, asked forgiveness.
Yeah.
And we made our peace. But we never stopped loving each other. I never disrespected my father. He just saw the world from a different, you know, he was an immigrant from a practical point of view. I get it.
Yeah, and that's important to recognize. The fact that your book also deals with creativity in the sense that Corina is a seeker. She doesn't know what she's seeking, but she's in the search. That to me is another powerful thing about the character. It doesn't always seem that we know where we're going, but there's that spirit that I don't know where I'm going, but I'm in the search. It's a powerful thing. And you can tell that Corina was open. She was hungry for something to happen.
You know, that adds a lot of who we are as young people, that we're waiting for something to happen. We don't know that we have to make it happen. Mm-hmm. We're just waiting. We think the right person will come in my life, especially women. If the right man comes in my life, then my life can change. Instead of working, helping your destino a little bit so that you can make that change happen. I think I spent most of my 20s, all of my 20s, like with that hope. And then realizing when I turned 30, oh, I'm wasting time. I got to make things happen. I better stop trying to please everybody and start working on my dream.
Beautiful, beautiful thing. I tell people that when they say, you know, when I'm in trouble and I'm drowning and I'm depressed, whatever, I say, well, the lifeline isn't really outside of you. There's always resources and help. The lifeline is inside of you. And that's what you got to remember. You have to pull yourself through that lifeline. Of course, it's great to have mentors and guides and friends. It's great to know there's a world out there that will help. I always said that, you know, when I finally figured out what I was going to do, the angels came out of the woodwork. I didn't even know they existed. I thought it was going to be a one single battle, but, you know, once I was clear, all of a sudden the angels popped up to all the people.
But don't you think, Luis, now that we're older, that we recognize that we have that strength inside us all along, that we have that. We just need to focus. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for me, it's always important that I understand I have a gift. I was born with it, but that's not going to make it great.
Yeah,
I've got to work on it, and I have a life path. And if I work really hard, then things will take off. And I have to remember, I'm not ever alone. I remind myself, I have my spirit allies. I have my ancestors. I want to make them proud every day in the work that I do. So when I start writing, I connect with my spirit allies. Mm-hmm. And I say, okay, you had a rougher life than I did. You had to migrate during the Mexican Revolution. You lost children during that pandemic of the Spanish flu.
Yeah.
And I'm here in this nice house and I work at home. I don't have to take the risk. I'm jumping on the back of a train to get to another country. I don't have to live under a tent like you did. All I need is to write a page and a quarter. Yeah. That's nothing. So please just channel your strength and your courage and help me with this. And once I feel connected to all my ancestors, all the survivors, I feel like I can do anything.
You know, I when I was a teenager, I didn't recognize it then, but I knew that I was kind of suicidal. I couldn't recognize it. I do have in my book the point where I tried to cut my wrist and I couldn't do it, but it was because there was a song in my head. And I realized as long as you have a song in your head, you're not going to commit suicide. The sad thing is I lost a lot of friends to suicide, even recently. In the last 10 years, I lost 3 friends. And I know how hard it is. So this is not an easy thing. But I felt that when you begin to see that thread of a purpose, it's very hard to want to destroy this life, even if you don't know where that purpose is going to take you. And I think that's very important for everybody to understand.
You know, Louise, I want to also confess that I also went through suicidal times in my life, especially when I was 33, the year of the cross. And it was because I was disconnected from everybody. I purposely disconnected. And when you're disconnected, you just feel your life is your own. And when you are connected, you realize that you're like this spider web, that whatever happens to you affects all these others. You can't just destroy yourself, because you will destroy your mother, your brother, your cousin, your grandmother, all these people who love you, your friends. You are part of the fabric of your being. And you can't just pull one thread. The whole thing will come undone. So, but however, when you're depressed, you don't realize that. You're so detached. You're disconnected on purpose. And your wound is so great that death seems like a beautiful solution. And I really did have to come back to the living. I felt like I was on an ice floe, too far away from anyone that could help me. And I'm very grateful that I had one friend, my friend Dennis Mathis, who's been alongside me, my fiction colleague that helped me write this story and many of my books. And he recognized, because he suffers from depression too, he recognized how gone I was. And he didn't say, you've got to talk to somebody. He made an appointment. He said, coming to Chicago. If you don't come to Chicago, I'll come and get you. That's how immobile I was. And the anonymity of coming to Chicago and talking to a Jungian therapist who nobody would know, I felt this great shame of being depressed. But I could do it secretly. And afterwards, I realized, well, there's nothing to be ashamed about. You know, depression's like any other illness, and you need to see a professional, you need to see a healer, you need to do a sweat or whatever is your medicine. But there's a lot of times you can't do it alone. There's no shame in that.
Yeah, I was taken by how a beautiful, bright day could never take away my friends. Suicide ideation. They were always in the dark. You know what I mean? Even a beautiful bright day couldn't do it. They were still in the dark. So I agree with you. I always tell people, make a move, any move, including talking to somebody, any move that allows you to get away from that dark.
Don't stagnate. You have to move. Creating. For me, I had stopped creating during that year. So I think creating is the antidote to your spirit dying.
It is. And I really agree with that. And that's been my story. Creation has helped me get through all this.
That's why we write, Luis, because to me, it's my medicine. Every time I write, it makes me a better human being, less angry and less small. It's my best self on the page.
Yeah, that's powerful. The practice of a creative act is very powerful. And you're an example of it. And this discussion, I think, shows how the depth of your own pain could be, but also the way you've been able to get through it by finding that creativity, by going towards it, making a move towards it. It isn't even about the final book. It's about making a move towards something creative. It could be a book. It could be all kinds of things. But I think that's important, that people could understand how powerful that is.
Well, to me, the great power of art is how we start from the darkest parts of ourselves, from the most degraded and humiliated parts. That's where I always begin, some horrible memories, things I wish I could forget. And I know that by writing poco a poco, slow by slow, little by little, it'll compost to a transformational moment when I will write something I didn't know I knew that will change me and suddenly make me see, oh, all of this darkness was so I could get here.
That's so powerful.
Or that was compost so I could get this little illumination.
You know, one day I was talking at some reading and there were some people outside that were former addicts that went and had a table just convince people to get some help. And this one lady, you can tell she was in bad shape. She just recently, like 6 months, she said she was recovered. And she looked at me and she says, you've had 28 years of drugs and alcohol. You don't look that bad. And I told her this, you're looking at me one of my best days of my life. You should have seen me in my worst days. because people don't realize that transformation is also, you can see it. Transformation is real. You know what I'm trying to say. And I think it's important for people to know so that they don't feel so bogged down that she'll transform too. A little bit more time on recovery. She's going to have those days where she realized, man, I didn't realize how far removed I am from that depth that I was in, because they still carry that depth for a long time. So that's important. The transformation, it's possible, it's palpable, it's real. It isn't just I'm stuck in, you know, as you know, anyone stuck in anything, whether it's suicide, whether it's I was on heroin and then drinking, all these terrible things that people can do to themselves. We can get through them if we understand that transformative capacity and that transformative power of something creator, something that's within you. To me, it's really vital.
One of the things that's great for me living in Mexico is I moved here to Mexico. I live in San Miguel. I don't feel alone here. Mm. Well, for one thing, everybody's always ringing my doorbell, but that's another story. But I mean, I feel connected to the spirit's world, my spirit allies, to all my ancestors, that whenever I feel like, you know, I used to feel sometimes in the United States, oh, if I die, my pets are going to eat me. No one will ever discover me until after 3 months. But I don't feel that in Mexico. I just feel this connection with community. I feel connected to my ancestors, to the spirit world. Yeah. The spirit world is much more vocal here for maybe because I'm listening more. And I never feel alone again, knowing that my spirit allies are here.
But the ghosts are always with everyone. And there's a story among the Tarahumara. My mother's descended from Tarahumara. So I went to the Sierra Tarahumara, the Copper Canyon. And there's one thing that they do. They have idea that after it gets dark, don't knock on anybody's door, because only ghosts will do that. So the ghosts are walking with them, but when it gets to a certain point, the ghosts come out. So if you show up,
let me tell you, they come out at twilight because my assistant Ernesto is intuitive, and he sees them. So he always tells me, don't put candles out at Day of the Dead, because we have enough ghosts coming through here.
That's exactly their attitude, and you know, but it's a good thing. They know those ghosts are real for them, and that's the way they live it, and they accept it. And it's not like they're terrible ghosts. It could be benign. It's just that they're there. And you can actually feel them, and you make a point, certain point, don't do certain things because the ghost.
Well, I only put the altares, and I have to do like a limpia, and only I put my altares for my ancestors. And I say, no vagabundos, only my guardians and my loved ones enter here when I do my altars.
That's beautiful. That's a beautiful thing. We're getting a lot of questions.
Oh, so I would love the questions.
I think let's get into some of them. And I'm going to just read them as I see them. The first one that I see here has to do with, how did you come up with the plot for the house on Mango Street?
All right, first I have to say, you think I think when I'm writing, and I'm not plot driven. Some authors are, but I don't come up with a plot. The plot comes to me. I don't go after it. I write from people and events and memories that it hurts me to think about. And so I write from that place, from here. And then I line, not in the order you see them in the book, in different order, like what I call buttons, I write the scenes. And even within one chapter, I'll write them and rearrange them and move them like the walnut game until I see, oh, this works best. And so I don't think about the plot. I just write from my corazón. And later, the plot surfaces like those old-timey photographs when they used to develop in the black room, the image rises. I don't even know what I'm creating when I'm writing it. It will come by itself. So I always tell students, think when you're editing, but not at the same time. Just feel when you're writing and do your drafts from this place. And then later on, shut this off and turn this on and do the editing.
And you can do that.
Yeah.
But you know what? I think it's a trust. It's a trust in intuition. It's a trust in the feminine. It's a trust in the spirit. Trust it. It will take you places. If you want to control it too much, you won't get into where it needs to go. So I do believe in that. I mean, there's a lot of skill that is required to write and everything, but open it up and trust that this plot, this story, this character will find their own way.
And let me add also, if you're doing it like to win a prize or to impress somebody, or you're thinking of the reader, you'll never write anything good because your ego mm-hmm. gets in the way. So to erase that, write as if what you have to say is too dangerous to get published in this time, and do it to honor your ancestors, and do it con puro amor on behalf of those you love. Do it as a service with no agenda of what and getting anything back. And then it'll come out in a pure, stronger, more beautiful way. You still will have to edit it, but yeah. I'm just talking about first drafts.
Yeah, you know what, I this is a great lesson in writing. I hope the writers can get this. I always like to use the feminine and masculine energies, because in Mexico, indigenous people, we always do that. And I have pointed out that the feminine is the constant and the masculine is the variable. The feminine is the leading energy and the masculine is secondary. It doesn't mean masculine is important. You can't have creation without either one of them. You need both. But what I find is the editing process to me is more the masculine.
Yes,
more of the paper, more of, okay, now the language, the word is this, but you got to first open up to that creative, imaginative space that the feminine really allows you to swim in. Be open to that and give it fullness, because the more fullness the imagination is, the more fullness the second part will be, you know.
That's right. Yeah. You're right. I like how you said that. I always phrase it a little differently. Like I'll say, when you're writing from the heart, it's like a mother who says, "That's nice, mijo. Anything right. you write, if that's so good, mijo. Oh, that's wonderful." So you do it from that feminine, loving mother part.
There you go.
And then you turn that off, and it's like the father says, "No, you got to move that. Cut that. Turn that around."
That's exactly right. Beautiful metaphor.
Yeah.
Beautiful. So, okay, good. This is a great lesson in writing. The next question has to do with your travels with your family. Did those travels help you beyond?
It broke up a little bit, so I want to make sure I understand the question. Did the travels to Mexico when I was a child?
Yeah, with your family to Mexico, did they help you when it came time for you to travel on your own to Mexico and beyond?
My father was a mama's boy, and without wanting to, he planted a seed in us to have a love of Mexico, to love of the Mexican culture, and to be aware of our history simply from the trips that we made and things that we saw. So without his being aware of it, he was planting a seed, especially in me, about feeling at home here, feeling most at home, more than in my hometown. So I think travel is essential for every human being, as you said. Mark Twain said, travel is the antidote to bigotry. If we want to teach children to be more generous and compassionate of spirit, we should take them to places where maybe they don't speak the language. My friend who lives around the corner is a handicapped individual who was born with only his arms up to here, and he used to travel to Mexico with his parents because, as he says, when he traveled in the United States, he's from the U.S., people would come up to his mother and father and scold them for, why did you take drugs that allowed your child to be born, when he wasn't one of those babies that was born because the mother had medication. So they felt that bringing their handicapped child to Mexico, that Mexico was more generous and kind to the handicapped and to the parents. And they didn't treat him like if he was a freak. Now he lives here and started a company that hires handicapped people and works within the community, in the country, with the people that might not get a job anywhere else. So, you know, see how life-changing that was for him traveling as a child? And that's why I think it's important that we take children outside of their zone of comfort to maybe take them into their destiny.
You know, I think because Mexico is poverty, and I know Mexico is more diverse now and there's a lot of layers to it, but one of my uncles was blind because he had chicken pox. And when my mom told me that, I go, I've got chicken pox. I didn't understand how they don't have the kind of help that we would get. So he's blind because he was a little kid. And then I had a sister who I never knew because she died before I was born, who died of diarrhea. And diarrhea doesn't kill people in this country, but in Mexico at the time, I don't care if you have diarrhea in your baby, you're going to die. It's just one of those things. People did not know how to deal with diarrhea. And sure enough, she was an infant. She got diarrhea. My dad used to sell chicharrones down the street in a basket. And unfortunately, he put the basket down and the little girl somehow crawled over, ate some chicharrones and gave her diarrhea. And they couldn't help her and she died. And they blamed him for it. He was completely blamed for her death. It was awful. He went through. That's why I think he got closed off. He had some things happen to him that I don't even know half of it. That alone is enough. But it is something where in Mexico, especially in those days, you didn't have too much room.
Even now, I'm here in Mexico, and we're waiting still for the second vaccines when all the first world countries have them and people don't even take them. And here people are waiting. The 40 to 50 year olds still haven't gotten their second vaccine. Forget about everybody younger. It's like, I was lucky that I was able to fly to the United States and get my vaccine. And I felt guilty about that because I wanted to wait with everybody. But I had high risk because of bronchial issues I had. So I said, I better go. And now I'm like, when is Mexico? Where are we in line? Are we in line? When are the Mexicanos going to have the medication that they need? They're in the back of the line.
That is where people forget we are one world. That the more developed countries are getting the help, but they don't realize that the less developed countries that don't get help, variants are coming from them that end up coming to get us. It's like you can't really help yourself in isolation.
That's
all the variants are coming from.
Of how interconnected we are.
Yes, absolutely. So anyway, I love Mexico. I'm glad you talk about Mexico like that. I've been going to Mexico for so many years, and in the beginning, they didn't really care for my Chicanismo, my being Chicano. No. But over the years, I would tell you honestly, they have become more open. My work is actually being used in some of the schools. I was at the Guadalajara Book Fair not long ago, and I was in panels all over the place, and media people talking to me because I can speak good Spanish. And that always throws up for a loop. You're a Chicano that speaks good Spanish. But they were more open because you know why? A lot of deportees over the last 20 years are Chicanados. You know what I'm saying? They don't really have the Mexican. So they have to deal with so many of them that now they have to address. Wait a minute, we can't just attack Mexicans for being Chicanos, for being pochos or whatever. We have to see that they're part of who we are. There are people who got pushed out or for whatever reason had to leave, but now they're being brought back and it's changing the country, as you know. And so now I think there's people that are more open, I find. More open to
I'm too, Luis. It's just getting older that I'm not afraid to make mistakes. Like the way I was when I was younger, I didn't want to do any interviews in Spanish because I didn't want to fail or have people make fun of my Spanish. But now, if I don't know a word, I just ask the interviewer or the audience, I'll say it in English. How do you say it? Oh, okay. And we just keep going. So it's
important.
Nice. That's a nice thing about getting older that you don't care what people think. Okay, now you're frozen.
Yeah, I know.
I
was 11 years old. I was 11 years old when we ended up in Ciudad Juarez to visit family. And I thought I spoke perfect Spanish because I spoke Spanish at home all the time. And I didn't know how imperfect it was until they made fun of us. All my cousins and everybody was like, what? And they were like, I thought I was a perfect Spanish speaker. Of course, I'm better at it now. But yeah, it's hard. It's hard to deal with that. I think there's another question. So let me see what this one. Okay. This is another question. It goes like this. How do you feel about Hispanic people not being represented in some schools and workplaces during Hispanic Heritage Month?
Well, maybe you can help me answer that because I don't know the answer to that question. Mm-hmm. There wasn't Hispanic Heritage Month when I was coming up, growing up. So I really don't have an answer for that. Do you have an answer, Luis?
Well, here's what I would say. I don't really care about Hispanic Heritage Month that much.
I feel it every day, right?
That's right. So in my community,
Hispanic Heritage, when you realize, if you really know your history, you were here before the world was round.
So it doesn't really impact me. I know it impacts others, which is fine. If people want to know about our heritage, our peoples, the diversity of our peoples, fine, that's a good month to learn it. But I never think about it as I'm in my community. My community's Spanish speaking, Mexican, Central American, beautiful, amazing combination of people. So I never think about it too much. I guess for others, it's fine. Like people invite me to do Hispanic Heritage Month things. I'm really doing it for others, you know, because
for me, it's every day. So I don't think about it as a certain time of the year. If it allows for schools to finally put some emphasis on people's heritage that come from the Americas, bravo. But to me, one of the things I learned when I left school is so much of my heritage was not taught to me. I had to discover it on my own. And I'm still learning, even now at 66, I'm still learning.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I don't find that our schools really teach that to anybody. Our kids, they don't really know who they are. They don't understand Mexico in this depth. And I think that's what would be the best thing, not just Hispanic Heritage.
You have a beautiful book club about social awareness at your bookstore. I also post books on my Instagram. And I'm always mentioning books that people should read, Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz's Indigenous People's History of the United States, an excellent book for young people to read so that you know, hey, we were here before it was the Americas, before the world was known as round. We have a presence here. So I really love looking at work by other Indigenous teachers, so that I can wake up and get the history that I didn't get when I was in school.
That's what I would recommend. People get these books in our schools. And again, Tia Chucha has a bookstore and does have a social justice book club. Whatever Sandra recommends, I know it's going to be powerful.
Yeah.
Get these books in these schools.
I just did an interview for Buy the Book for the New York Times book review section, which I named you in there. I don't know if you saw it, Luis, as one of the writers I admire. And there's a whole list of books that I recommend and talk about. So Google that and put my name in, buy the book, and from the book review section, and you'll see it.
And I just to say that I've known that to be true for Chicanos and others when I came up, how gracious all of you were to me. I say all of you because it was Rodolfo Anaya, and it was Jose Montoya, and it was yourself and Ana Castillo. Everybody that was out there writing before I started getting published were always good to me. You know what I'm saying?
You know what? I'm so glad to hear that because people weren't always good to me.
I know that.
I know they beat me up, you know?
Yeah, but you guys learned. You all learned.
House on Mango Street, that's not a Chicano book, you know?
No, but you learned. You learned that you're not going to do that to others because I was never treated that way. Everybody was kind to me. I really don't recall somebody being mean, ugly to me. You know, we lost Greg Guarios recently. When my book Always Running first came out, he's one of the first ones to interview me and try to make sure that the book was out there. I find all of them, Gary Soto, all of them were always
Gary Soto helped me a lot, and Lorna D. Cervantes published my first book.
Lorna D. Cervantes was great.
Yeah.
So I would just have to say that. Maybe I came in after you all learned the hard way. I came in with some really good.
You didn't move to South Texas. That was your good luck.
There you go. That was beautiful. So that's always good. Help somebody else. Here's another question. Do you think that a non-native Spanish speaker can responsibly use Spanish within a story with a Mexican protagonist?
I think so. But, you know, I'm one of those people that want everybody that's working alongside me, if you're doing it with respect. And if you're doing it with intimacy, and if you get it proofread by people who are from that community and you're working alongside us with the right cause, other people are going to say different things, but I'm going to say you're my ally. You're my ally if you're working alongside me.
I think it's being authentic and real. And if you can do that, that's powerful what writers can do. If you're phony and you're misrepresenting, that's not cool, regardless who you are. But I noticed that one time, because I went to Tokyo to catch the lowrider scene. I was there, I did poetry readings and things, but I also went into the cholo stores. They had cholo stores. And people were telling me that they were appropriating, but I told them, not the people that I knew. They were very respectful. They got into the lowrider culture scene. They got into the Cholo style, but they always gave Chicanos the respect. This is Chicano. They didn't take it.
About listening and respect, that's to me is key.
Yeah, and they were always true too. They were always true to the culture. They didn't misapply it. So I think it's true. You can tell when people are appropriating and you can tell when people are respectfully adapting or taking into other cultures. So yeah, thank you for that. I think it's really important, I think, if you don't mind, do you have a section of Martita that you'd like to read?
Yeah, my book fell on the floor, so I'm going to, you know, okay. When I'm adjusting, so I'm going to dive and get my book.
Be right there you back. Go.
Yeah, I have it right here. My glasses fell too. I don't know if you heard the clatter. You want me to read something?
I think you should read something. It'd be nice to hear your voice with the story, part of that story.
But the book's out on audio too. And it's really wonderful because I did it with two actors and it sounds great.
Amazing. So
just I'll just do one paragraph. It makes me sick to count my money. To look and see how little is left. I try not to think about it. Every day I have less and less, the money dribbling out like in the French public phones where you drop the coins in the machine and watch them all drop click through the plastic chutes like a waterfall. The phone swallows and swallows. It wants more and more francs, but I don't want to go home. I've come from so far away because Paris is the city of dreams. Not yet, not yet, not yet. That's complicated. You can get more on the audio, which is so much fun to do. I love doing
audio. I love audiobooks.
I did it, and Luis, I did it for the very first time. I did the Spanish audio too.
Oh, good. Beautiful.
Wonderful. Talk about getting over your inhibitions about speaking Spanish to have to do it in the studio. Wow, that was hard.
Well, that's the key though, to do it. I tell people just do it and you'll be good. Keep doing it.
Yeah.
My Spanish wasn't that good either, but I've been speaking so much, even with all my mistakes, and I learned. Now I've spoken in Argentina and in Spain. I've done big events, and it's like you just learn. You eventually get the confidence.
I find people are very, I always explain, you know, my education was in the United States. My family emigrated, so that's my first language, and Spanish is my second, but I'm going to try. And when I make mistakes and I don't know something, will you help me? And the audience always roars, yes.
Yes.
So it's kind of great to have them.
Because you're respectful about it. And you know, one thing they don't realize, at least when I went to school, may not have been your situation, but when I went to school starting in Watts, they would punish you for speaking Spanish. They would literally take the office and swat you. So. Yeah. I couldn't speak Spanish in the classes, which is terrible. And I spoke it at home. Thank God my parents always spoke Spanish. That kept it alive for me. But you couldn't speak it in public. That was awful. I'm glad that's changed. If it happens anywhere in the United States today, people should get pissed off because that's awful to destroy people's ability to speak and communicate. They can learn more languages. Language is learnable. As you know, people in the world speak 2-3 languages. They have to. It shouldn't be hard, but I do think it's terrible that people would say Spanish or any language, the indigenous people whose languages are taken away from them. Anybody who loses their languages to me is awful. And we need our languages and we can learn more. That's the way the world goes. So it's kind of hard for me to think about India. Now we got maybe 5 more minutes or so. But I want you to talk a little bit about, we were kind of touching upon it. The solidarity of being a writer, the solidarity in the sense that you're connected with so many people, but at the same time, it's a very lonely act, you know? And yet you gotta have your spirit allies, as you say, your ancestors, hopefully your friends that you know are around. But the act is actually quite lonely. And maybe you can speak a little bit about that because it could be, I've seen some writers who just hide in themselves and lose connection and they're writing, some of them are writing great books, but I always find it that it's just the nature of writing that you have so many support and friends and everything. But when you're sitting there, it's you and that paper
You know what helped me a lot, Luis, and I miss, you know, I miss our get-togethers, like when Denise Chavez was organizing the Border Book Festival. To me, that was family reunion, because my real family doesn't understand what I'm doing. And when I would run into you or Martinez Bava or any other writer, it was so great to hang together. And even just seeing each other once a year on that reunion spirit, or Macondo, that's why I created it. I created Macondo Writers Workshop so I would have family and not feel so isolated in Texas. And, you know, you're coming and sharing your wisdom with the younger writers and Joy Harjo and all the people, Elena Poniatowska, all the people that have gifted us with their presence and their wisdom. All of that is my family. You know, my friendships with people like Joy and Liliana Valenzuela, who translated my book. And, you know, all of these writers, I tend to, and I was saying this to Dorothy Allison the other night when we did an interview on the book. I said, people think that we're in contact, but it'll be like 10 years before I see her, because I know how when we write, it's like going underground into the coal mine and mining there and chipping away the labor of writing a novel, writing a book of poetry. It's very, very internal, lonely work. And it takes a great deal of effort to get in the zone and then to come up again. So I make appointments, but you're reminding me to reconnect with all of us that are of a generation, because we don't have those opportunities, those reunions anymore. Border Book Festival doesn't exist. I retreated from Macondo Writers Workshop, and COVID has kept us meeting each other virtually. So I just need to be reminded that to stay connected with the other writers, because I need my spiritual family, because you all understand, when you look at a book, every page is how many hours of solitude?
Yeah.
Every page. So you do the math and think, oh my God, that's a lot of weeks there. And your family doesn't understand that, but no. Your colleagues.
That to me is so beautiful. It's so important for writers to know, for others to know. Writing is that work. You're into a place, like you're saying, you're deep in the earth, your own internal earth. And yet you still have to have a sense of community.
Yes.
That you're a part of something bigger.
Yes.
That community can always nurture you. I always tell people, community to me is my mother. You know, I have to come up to air and connect with community, because I don't get nurtured and this community is in my life. And I know you have
others. We nurture others, but who nurtures us, right?
Exactly. So and I know you do that, because even with Macondo and other things, you have created communities that are still existing and are still moving out there into the world. So to me, that's powerful. Very few writers, but I know a lot of writers that don't think about that. But I find my nurturing happens outside my writing, but at the same time, I got to close that door and I got to be in that deep depth of the mine, as you say, and mining that, the mud and the gold, because there's a lot of minerals in that mine.
Well, so, like Han says, you know, you have to have the mud for the lotus flower to blossom. So no mud, no lotus flower.
You gotta, and people should recognize that. It's not about just being the glitter. You know, to get to that gold, sometimes you got to go through a lot of mud, and that's okay. Anyway, I want to say how much I love you. I love your work. I want you to be safe, to be in Mexico someday when all the pandemic's done, and I know it'll happen. We'll make an arrangement.
I don't say that to
love it. Trini loves you. No, Trini.
Yeah, please, you need to take care of yourselves and come and get nurtured. Mexico's so wonderful. And even with all the problems that Mexico has, I feel safer here than I do in the United States. Or maybe it's just that the news makes each country look worse. I don't know.
Yeah, I think most places, even I've been to the worst place you can imagine. Most places are beautiful. I was talking to somebody about El Salvador. I've been there many times. It is very violent. It's true. It's got a lot of poverty. But I found the people amazingly beautiful and decent. Honduras. I was in Honduras for a month. One of the most violent countries in the world. Beautiful people. the gente and the suffering. Like whenever I meet a Haitian, I've never been to Haiti, but I know they go through hell and back. But every time I meet a Haitian, I meet a decent human being. So we can hang on to our decency. We can hang on to love. We can hang on to our comradeship. We can hang on to our fellowship and our communities. Don't let the pandemics, war, all these things that are real, destroy that. And that's why I think good writing can do.
Reminding us that we can change the world if we just change everyone we come into contact with.
There you go. And I think we should probably say goodbye. I hate to do this, but I think it was a great discussion. I am energized. Gracias por todo. And let's do it again. But I just want to wish you well and everybody out there.
Luis, también, you know, please invite me if you want to do something for Tia Chuchas. I'm your ally.
Okay.
Do.
So for all you out there, thank you for listening. Buy the book. You're going to love it. Buy the audio book. You're going to love that.
Yeah.
So
remember, you know, everybody can create an act of peace by reading a story to somebody. Absolutely. Taking a book out of the library.
Absolutely.
Writing, making art. That's, I think, what we need to do.
And for you and me, I'm sure it's true. Books saved my life. I was a pretty messed up kid, but I love that library and I love reading. I don't know what
I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for the public library.
There you go. Thank you all. Nos vemos.
Thank you, Luis. Take care of Trini, take care of your family, and take care of you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.